Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the Lucky Few podcast, where we are shifting the narrative by shouting the worth of people with Down syndrome. This is Micah,
Mercedes,
and Heather.
And today we are joined by our friend and fellow lucky mama, Elena Fong, as we continue celebrating Black History Month. We are so excited to learn more about her advocacy work and experience as a mixed race woman raising a child with Down syndrome. Thank you for joining us, friends. Welcome to the Lucky Few podcast.
This episode's sponsor is Jonas Paul Eyewear. Jonas Paul's mission is to help kids feel beautiful and confident in their glasses. Jonas Paul Eyewear offers prescription glasses starting at $79, including prescription lenses, and non-prescriptive blue light glasses starting at only $59. Listen to the end of the episode to get a discount code and learn more.
I'm so excited about today's interview. And before we jump in, I would love to read another one of our supporters' reviews. Okay, this one is from Chadwick's. While I have a kiddo with different abilities than DS, this show is encouraging, thoughtful, provoking, and refreshing for parents of all sorts of kids. The panel are well-spoken and insightful with lots to add to our cultural conversation surrounding different abilities. We dads are listening out here too.
A dad.
I know.
A dad.
Hey, Chad. Chad the dad.
Chad.
Love you, Chadwick.
Chadwick. I don't know what your full. Yeah, Chadwick will call you that. Yes. Hey, dad.
Thank you for listening. And, everyone else, don't forget to review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts so we can read it aloud next week. We love reading these and appreciate your support so, so much.
So, so much.
So, so much.
So, guys, hey, here we are. We're like, you know, just working our way through February and all the things that February has been for people everywhere. So I would love to know. I'm thinking of Texas right now as we record.
I know.
All iced over and frozen and all of that. And man, just that it's 2021 is taking us for a ride.
I know. It's too much. My brother is there. He's been there a year. I'm born and raised in California, so he was not prepared for what.
So he didn't have a sled.
He doesn't have a sled. He didn't have, like, you know, an earthquake or I guess snowstorm kit. Like, I don't know, very unprepared. And just all the friends that we follow on Instagram showing us what they're going through in Texas. It's mind blowing and sad and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's been a lot, but there have been good things happening this February.
Yeah.
And one of those is our emphasis on Black History Month. And we have had some really amazing interviews. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to throw it at you two. What have you thought of our interviews so far this month? And what have you been learning?
Oh,
or so thinking about?
Special. I know. I feel like I just love the emphasis on the moms who are Black and women of color. Like, I've just really, really loved that and in full support and just really appreciative that our podcasts are highlighting those voices, because I just want those moms who are leaders in this space to continue to have an uplifted voice and for people to know them and follow them. And I don't know. I just really, really love that. I've been kind of silent on my social media because of family and life stuff. And I've just really dove into, in our homeschool, teaching my kiddos about Black history, talking about slavery. And that's been eye-opening of being not like being a homeschool mom, not sending them to school and let the school handle that, but taking my own initiative and talking about that. And I don't know if other parents do that who have kiddos in public school, but I know for me, that was like a aha moment. Like, oh wait, I'm going to teach this, you know, like I'm going to be the one to introduce that. And even though I have kindergarten, first grader and preschooler, I still think there's ways to introduce Black history, the truths about slavery in a way that they can understand. And yeah, I think it's important. So that's where I've been at.
That's awesome.
I love that, Mercedes. And I really, really value, highly, highly value and appreciate people who take the time to share their stories and experiences. And so our guest this month, you know, as a white woman, as women of color, their experience as a parent to a child with disability is going to be different than mine because their experience in the world is different, which all of ours are. But it's the way that that people of color are viewed by systems in the world and the way that people with disabilities are, there's crossover there and there's an experience being lived out that is not mine. And I just am so grateful for women and moms and people in general, but especially mamas who share their stories and their lived out experiences, because there's so much value in that to learn from. And, you know, books are great and it's like a both and. The historical part of Black people in America and African Americans is so important. And also the stories today are so important and relevant. And there's all the crossover, right? Like one leads to the next, to the next, to the next. So I'm grateful that we get to hear from people of color and from women who are Black raising kids with Down syndrome about their experiences in this space. Cause we need that. We need to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am really happy to hear you talking about that, Mercedes. And I think that choosing to read books with your kids at home, whether you're a homeschool parent or, you know, homeschooling right now while kids are virtual, or whether that's just something that you're reading before bed. I think that's really, I love that you brought that up. And I hope, Merce, that you'll share some of the books that you've been reading with your kids. Maybe we can add them to our, I want to say playlist. Why do I want to say playlist?
Show notes.
That's it.
I will. I thank you for asking. I feel like that's still a touchy subject to introducing slavery, because I do feel like a lot of people can think of one, like, white was wrong during this time and Black was right. Like, I feel like there's still a lot of like blame and shame. So I will share my books.
Yes.
Do with it what you will.
But well, I will, listeners, we shall give you a list.
We shall give you a list.
You will.
Awesome. Well, without further ado, let's continue this conversation. We're so excited that our friend Elena is here today. And she has so much to talk to us about. So welcome to the show, Elena Fong.
Thank you. Hi, ladies. Thank you for having me.
Hello. You're welcome. Hello. We're so excited.
I'm excited. Fangirling, like I said.
Same here, right? Fangirling you.
Elena and I were in real life friends, y'all, in the Bay Area. And
yes.
So we got to spend some time with some other Bay Area moms of kids with Down syndrome, and just really fun to see you here today on my screen.
Me too. I'm excited. I wish we got to hang out more.
I know. I know that COVID just really messed some stuff up. Well, Elena, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your family and what you do for your career, and what you are, I guess, mention a little bit more also about the Black Disabled Lives Matter movement.
Sure. Yeah. As you guys know, my name is Elena. I live here in Oakland, California. I'm married to my husband a little over 10 years now. And we have two kids. I have my daughter, Winter, who is 4 and a half, and she has Down syndrome. And my son, Nova, who just turned 3 in December. So I don't work. Pandemic.
Because you have been in fashion for a long time, right?
Yeah, well, retail. Okay. So I worked as a personal shopper / stylist for about 6 years for a big, retail chain, which I won't mention, because the way that I left that company wasn't on good terms. And after I left there, I went and worked for a small business here locally, a brick and mortar, where, she invested in women designers, things that were made sustainably. And I learned a lot about sustainable fashion through working at that business, which I'm so grateful for. And then she actually closed right before the pandemic hit. And timing is everything, right? And then, Winter was out of school. And I've just been home ever since. And so, you try to do your best in terms of staying informed and being there for your child and supporting their needs, educationally, therapy, all of that stuff. I want to say that, during this pandemic, I think for everyone, right? Like, we're stuck at home, we're forced to pay attention. And, with the Black lives that were lost due to police brutality, how could you not want to do something? How could you not be affected by it? And I think that's where it just kind of catapulted me into, learning more, researching, reading articles, discovering, activists online and through social media. And that's just how I came across the Black Disabled Lives movement, which honestly, it's been happening for a very long time. I think, the rest of us are just now realizing it and seeing it. There have been Black disabled activists that have been a part of our history for a very long time that have created change and been a part of change, And I just wanted to learn more. I think being a mom that has a child with a disability, it kind of naturally went into that direction. And also being a woman of color and, wanting to be an ally in this movement, it just became one of those things that was really important to me and that I wanted to share and spread awareness around.
Okay. I want to ask you to talk a little bit. I want to hear a lot more about, I know that you were a part of this mural project, that I'm excited for you to share more about that and more about what you've learned when you've dove into your research. But I would love to know more about the two cultures that have cultivated your identity. So no one can see you, but
no.
would you refer to yourself as biracial?
I identify as mixed race.
Okay.
So, because I'm not biracial. So my mother is half Japanese and half Black. And then my father is Chinese.
Okay.
And, growing up, I definitely had a greater connection to my Asian cultures. My mom came from Japan. My father came from Hong Kong, China. And when those two lives became one and they had me, they're both immigrants. They're, trying to assimilate and to be a part of American society. And so a lot of what they taught me was how to do the same. It was just English that was spoken in the household. I think my father did his best to expose me to my Chinese culture. But my parents got a divorce when I was really young. So I was 3 years old, and I was the every other weekend visit with my father, and my grandparents owned a restaurant. So that was how I stayed close to my Chinese culture. You know, I was helping out in the kitchen. You know, I'm hearing my grandparents and my dad and my uncle speak Chinese. I did, you know, we went to Oakland Chinatown for dim sum, which was always exciting, but also kind of a very hard experience to go through as a young child, because I think that was my first sense of understanding that I looked different. You know, maybe to others, I do not, you know, but, you know, comparing myself to someone who is fully Chinese, I am considered dark. Mm-hmm. My hair is curly. You know, also I didn't speak Chinese. Mm-hmm. So I got a lot of looks. I got a lot of like, you know, who is this, you know, dark skinned child with you? And because my dad actually remarried. So he remarried a Chinese woman, had two kids. And I just kind of like looked like I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. And it was made very clear on my dad's side of the family that there was a difference. You know, I had an uncle get married. My whole family was sitting at a table. I sat with the guests. I did not feel a part of that family. I didn't feel accepted. And, you know, when it comes to my mom's side of the family, she was adopted. So she was brought to the States, adopted by a Japanese woman and her Black husband. You know, they matched her basically and was brought to the United States. And, you know, I won't speak too much on her experience, but, you know, it was a very hard and, you know, she faced a lot of adversity growing up. So there was, you know, she had a greater exposure to her Japanese culture, and, you know, she didn't speak Japanese to me really. I mean, there were a few words that she would say and didn't really tell me stories. I think there's a lot of hurt and pain there. But she tried to keep me connected through food. So, you know, she was taught how to cook at a very early age. So, you know, I was exposed to Japanese and, you know, Black soul food. Like, I grew up on that with my mother. And so when it comes to identity, it's like, I am fully aware of what I am mixed with and who I am in terms of nationality. Culturally, I explain it away as being very American. And I am currently on a journey of, you know, discovering my identity and, you know, really owning it and feeling proud of it and just wanting to feel more connected to all of those cultures combined. And I think when you go through that and going through a pandemic and, you know, everything being so polarized, there's a lot that happens, right? There's, it exposes vulnerabilities, it exposes pain, it exposes trauma. And yeah, I think I'm still in the process, in the process of that.
I'm wondering how having a child with Down syndrome has played into your searching out this process, talking about finding your identity, if at all. Has winter played a role in that for you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, because not only am I working to, you know, cultivate this confidence for Winter to be proud for having, you know, being who she is, not only, you know, recognizing that she has Down syndrome, that's a part of her, and that it's something that she should be proud of, but she also, it's something I want her to be proud of being multiracial as well, and owning that, and seeing the beauty in that, that everything that makes her Winter is absolutely incredible. You know, and the way that, you know, we all know this about our kids, but the way that they love and the way that they love so unconditionally and the empathy and compassion that they show, I think is huge when it comes to identity as well, and embracing people for who they are, you know, differences and all, and seeing the beauty in that, you know. I mean, I thought I was a pretty open and empathetic person, but I had no idea until I had Winter. Absolutely no idea.
I love that what you're saying about that all the parts of her that make her herself. And, you know, that's a conversation that I've had with my older boys about Ace. Like, he would not be himself without that extra chromosome in every one of his cells. He would be a different person. And like, how that's one way that we've learned to celebrate his Down syndrome is that it has made him the human that he is. And to think about that in terms of Winter, like how many beautiful parts of her in terms of her, the cultures and the identities that have come together in her life that make her herself. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's so sweet too, like, you know, the relationship that my mother has with Winter. I feel like the things that she's passing down to her are maybe things that she didn't do with me. And I think that's absolutely beautiful. And it makes me so happy to see that. I love seeing the joy that Winter brings, not only to, you know, myself and my family, but to others around us. You know, I mean, you ladies know, like, on social media and having DMs of people saying, oh, I just love seeing your children because it brings me so much joy. You know, the joy that they radiate and the joy that they share, there's no comparison, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Can you tell us, and maybe our listeners are same as me, with the Black Disabled Lives Matter movement, what is that about? What's going on? What's wrong? What are we tackling here? Can you kind of give us intro to that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert, but for myself, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, as we were seeing Black people being killed in the street, as we're seeing, you know, police brutality and violence against, you know, Black men and women, Black children, you know, you start reading articles, you start coming across stories. And one article that I came across in particular that really stood out for me and kind of like catapulted me into this, like, this is important, like, I need to share this, was the statistic that up to 30 to 50% of deaths caused by law enforcement were people with disabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is outrageous. And then you couple that with someone who is Black and also having a disability, that's a death sentence. Mm-hmm. You know, I picture, you know, and I had shared this in a post where, you know, I'm sitting here picturing, you know, a police officer, you know, pulling over, you know, a Black man or a Black woman who may be neurodiverse, and they're saying, put your hands up. Right. And because they're neurodiverse, they cannot comply.
Right.
And then what is going to happen? How terrifying is that? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what needs to be shared, because I feel once that is shared, that it just kind of starts the conversation. It opens up the conversation about, you know, defunding the police and funding resources within our community, you know, social services, homelessness, housing, all of those things. Those are the things that are what we need in order to help our communities, to help the people that live here. And, one of the things that like really kind of resonated with me is the fact that, you know, I feel what ends up happening is, you know, we kind of get stuck on a movement or a subject or a social justice issue, but then we leave out people with disabilities,
yep.
right? Mm-hmm. Like when we're talking about policy change or, you know, equity in terms of healthcare and all of those things, like people with disabilities need to be a part of that conversation. I was reading an article not that long ago, and not that it was, you know, anything huge, but it was just like a light bulb went off, you know, with the pandemic. You know, restaurants were closed, so they tried to find other solutions, right, to be able to keep their business running. So they created outdoor seating or extensions of their businesses, which inevitably some of them would block sidewalks. Wow. And so people with mobility issues, you know, that may be in a wheelchair or using some sort of walking assistance, they can't get across. They're, yes, they're over there walking into the middle of the street. Mm-hmm. And those, and little things like that, that are huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's those things that we all need to be aware of and be conscious of,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, you know, that's kind of like where this movement has, you know, guided me or brought me, is just the awareness of disability as a whole. Mm-hmm. But you couple that with being someone who is Black in America, having a disability.
Right.
I mean, it's just a terrifying combination.
I was at the Joni and Friends Family Camp 2019, and there was this sweet, super friendly, kind man who's neurodiverse, who just generally wanted to make connections. So he would ask everybody, you know, who, what's your Facebook? Can I have your number, or can I follow you on Facebook? And I remember talking to my husband, Andy, having it heavy on my heart that I needed to tell this friend that he needs to be careful about asking people this. Because my experience that I've had in vocational work, so I used to be a person that was a one-on-one, I guess, helper aid for adults. I just know that often places to hang out would be like the mall, or places to hang out would be like parks. And I just was flooded with stories of moms who feel like uncomfortable because this person's come up to them excessively, you know, and they aren't aware that maybe he has a neurotypical disorder. You know, like, it's just so hard when it's not Down syndrome, when it's not physically apparent, it's so hard to not think like this person's being a creeper. I feel like that's mm-hmm. automatically creeper, drunk, drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I talked to him, the guy at the camp. And his mom affirmed that this was a situation that he would get himself in trouble with, that when he's out and about and he's tall, he's Black, you know, he's very friendly. And you could hear in his voice something's different. But again, it's not people's first go-to. Oh, right. This person has a disability. That's not their first go-to. It's yep. the fear, you know, and scared, mm-hmm. and this person, drugs, I feel like, or alcohol is a go-to. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about that, and it's hard because, I mean, I have my sunflower, she has repetition, she has things she does that I can tell her over and over again, okay, you know, let's move on, let's do something different. But this is ingrained, it's something natural, it's something that doesn't change easily. And for this mom, she was like, yeah, it's we have this conversation all the time.
Yeah. We've talked about, and I've talked to Black families who have kids with Down syndrome about being grateful that our kids wear their disability on their face. Yes. In certain scenarios and other scenarios, it can be to a disadvantage, but I think that's a great example, Mercedes, you know, and even that statistic that you talked about, Elena, with the police brutality and that how many people who have been shot by police and have a disability that mm-hmm. they're most likely not wearing on their face, mm-hmm. you know, or it's not as evident that there's a mm-hmm. disability there. It's so complicated and it's so important. The awareness piece is just so important for all of us, you know, for all of us. And then there is that added layer of being a person of color mm-hmm. in the United States and having a disability that you wear or not, you know, and mm-hmm. how your interaction with the world is just going to be different and harder in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And I think too, you know, with my mural, that was something that like came very, you know, I had come, when I came across that article with a statistic, I came across the logo and artwork of Jen White Johnson, who is a Black, she is Afro-Latina disabled activist, and she's an artist. And, you know, I think it opens the conversation up to people about, one, starting with what is disability? How do you define disability? It's not something that's so obvious and evident, like you said, Heather. It's, you know, the invisible, it's mm-hmm. health ailments, it's, you know, certain conditions, like maybe like heart condition or, mm-hmm. you know, something that isn't so obvious. And I think that's, you know, where it starts is for people to understand that and be aware of that, you know, like, and mental illness as well. You know, I can share a little bit personally, like my father, and I've shared this before, you know, he has schizophrenia. So he's actually, you know, when he isn't on his meds and he's had a mental break, the police are always called. Mm-hmm. They're always called. And the police are the wrong people to handle these situations. Mm. Time and time again, it is very obvious. They are not capable. They are not prepared. They are not trained to handle these situations, to de-escalate them. You know, my father has been taken to jail, you know, and where, that's not where he should be. That's not where he's going to get the help that he needs. Mm-hmm. And with my father, for him, you know, when he has his breakdowns, he becomes very confrontational, mm-hmm. you know, which inevitably would end up in a fight or a struggle. And, you know, I'm so grateful that, you know, he is still alive, that it's never ended in, you know, fatality or losing his life, because I could so easily seeing that happen, you know? So those are the things that us as a society, as a nation, that we need to recognize. Just because it doesn't affect you directly, it affects your neighbor, it affects, you know, people of your community, and all of that needs to be important to us, right? I think that's the one thing in America, that we have this very individualistic type of mentality. It's not a very collective kind of thinking of all of us together. And that's really sad. It's really sad. Like, how do we get through life? How do we, you know, succeed without the support of others? Mm-hmm. We can't do life by ourselves, right?
I did want to touch on one thing because you said it and it's a hot word. Mm-hmm. And I want you to explain it more because it is a hot word that I thought divided even our community. Defund the police. Mm-hmm. You know, give us the definition in the ways that I feel I would align with your definition, but share with everyone what that means and what we would use that money for and what it doesn't mean. I don't know. Go for it.
Okay. I mean, so defunding the police has many definitions. I think it has the very obvious definition of defunding the police, actually getting rid of law enforcement. And there are people that believe that and want to create something new. And then there's people like me that believe that we still need law enforcement, but I want to take away certain responsibilities from them. I want us to stop funding them and giving them all of this money in order to be in charge and to have the responsibility of things that they are just not capable of being in charge of or having the responsibility of having. So like when it comes to dealing with homeless or mental illness, those are the things I don't want them to be in charge of. I don't want them to have that responsibility. I want us to fund programs. I want us to fund resources that are going to help, you know, people with mental illness and to help the homeless. That's where the funding needs to go, and it needs to go directly into the communities. That's my belief. And, you know, I feel those that want to get rid of the police completely is because of how rooted, you know, law enforcement in America is in white supremacy and racism, that the root of law enforcement is there, you know, and they want to dismantle it completely and let's build something new. Let's start with a new foundation. And I get that too, you know? Mm-hmm. But I do believe that we do need law enforcement in terms of handling, you know, violent crimes. Like, but it, you know, it's been shown and it's, you know, it's been said that like more than half of the calls that police go out to aren't violent. It's not the robberies. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, these violent attacks or, you know, someone being murdered or raped. Like that's not the majority of their job, their right. duty, their day-to-day duty. And all of our money is going towards supporting less when we could be supporting people that are actually experts in handling those in, you know, domestic disputes or, you know, someone having a mental break. Like, mm-hmm. that's where we should be putting the money. Mm-hmm. And also in education, public education.
Imagine that.
I mean, come on, right? Like, yes. I am right now struggling because, mm-hmm. you know, winter is going into kindergarten. I don't know what happened during this pandemic, but I thought she could repeat pre-K. I don't know why. And I get a call and they're like, you're supposed to choose a kindergarten. What? She's not going back to the same school. No. Now she's going into kindergarten. We need to know your choice. And for us, we can't afford private. So we have to choose a public school. Out of the 13 public schools in our district, I'm supposed to figure it out from home, mm-hmm. never having even been in this environment before.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm, you know, she went from her early intervention services to her pre-K school, which is just that. It's a special education, you know, for preschool and pre-K. And that's it. And that was her only option. I didn't even have to choose. Like, that was just where mm-hmm. she was going to go.
Right.
So it's like figuring all of this out and not having the support that we need in order to make informed decisions for our children. Like, yeah, it's just I get a little heated when it comes up, but I just, you know, the frustration level. And I think, you know, we've all, you know, like I said, we've been stuck at home, we've been forced to pay attention, And then also feeling a little bit like, oh, I can't believe I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Why didn't I take the time to learn about this? Mm-hmm. You know? And I just, you know, the more that I learn and the more that I become aware, the more angry and frustrated I get. But it also, you know, sparks this, like, I want to do my part. I want mm-hmm. to do more, mm-hmm. you know, and starting at, you know, the community level within my own neighborhood, you know, being a part of my neighborhood and decisions and, you know, leaders, you know, local leaders and choosing those and being informed about that, starting there, starting locally, I think is where we all should start, yeah. you know, in order to create change.
Yeah. I think that anger into action is then righteous indignation. Mm. So like you step into that action and, or you, because I think we can take anger, and I find this for myself, even just as a parent to children with disabilities, and I can become so angry at a system that is an unjust system. Let's just start naming them schools, you know, like churches, community, yeah. everywhere. But yeah. I can become so angry, and that anger, I think, can create bitterness, or it can usher us towards action, mm-hmm. which can feel overwhelming. But all those things you just said, like start local, you know, mm-hmm. walk down to your local police department and say, what do you guys do if, yeah. you know, if my neighbor who has schizophrenia has a breakdown, how do the police get involved? Who are the social workers? Like, start asking the questions and showing up in the ways you can. And yeah. I think as moms who have kids with disabilities, there's not a choice there. And that we've talked about this before. To not choose advocacy is a privilege. And as people of color, there is no choice there, right? You mm-hmm. advocate for yourself in a world of where white supremacy reigns. And so mm-hmm. there's no choice. And I think white people and other people of privilege can live in their privilege, and they'll all of a sudden they have a kid with Down syndrome, you know, mm-hmm. which you don't control. Yeah. And then you're like, whoa. And it just opens up this whole world, and you can't help but have to give up that privilege of not having to advocate. Mm-hmm. And I think initially it starts like for the individual, but then it grows and grows and grows. And I all of the like shouting the worth of people with disabilities that we talk about, and shouting the worth for our kids with Down syndrome, it's in hopes of those who have the privilege to not advocate, choosing to do so for the greater good, which in itself is for them, right? Like, it comes back full circle every time. Absolutely. It comes back full circle.
Every time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jeez.
Being a woman of color, like, I, you know, I still recognize my privilege, and it took a lot mm-hmm. of self-reflecting and really confronting my own biases and prejudices and really recognizing those things and getting uncomfortable. Like, yes. you know, there's that saying going around, get comfortable with the uncomfortable, because mm-hmm. that is the only way that we are really going to be honest and truthful and create change. Like, there's a reason why you feel uncomfortable. So you're confronting something that you've held close, you know? And, you know, I am not a Black woman. I know that. And I know that I don't face the same, you know, type of discrimination or racism as a Black woman would. And I recognize that. And there's an importance in recognizing that. I'm not going to lump myself, you know, with a Black woman. Like, I get that. You know, I am married to a white man. Being read as just Asian or whatever it may be, there is privilege associated with that. And I get that. And I think that's too where we all should start, is recognizing our own privileges. And how are you going to use that?
Yes.
How are you going to use that and create change? And to, you know, I love this saying by, I don't know if you ladies are familiar with Andrea Levant. She mm-hmm. is an inclusion advisor, but she's, you know, an activist. And she says, you know, people with disabilities don't just want a seat at the table. We want a meal as well. Mm-hmm. We don't just want the seat. We want a meal as well. And that goes for every marginalized group. You know, I think that just goes as a whole, as women, as people of color, as people with disabilities. That goes for all of us. Like, we don't just want a seat. We want the meal too, you know? So grateful for you ladies for making space. I still struggle, honestly. Like, I still struggle feeling like I have that I have a seat at the table, that I can share space, because I don't know if I necessarily feel that I'm at the same successful level, or you know, I still struggle with that, and I'm learning that what I have to bring to the table is valuable as mm-hmm. well, that my story is valuable as well. It's hard, but like, I think it's something that you have to kind of like force yourself to do. And I think when people like you ladies allow it to happen and say like, no, we want you here. This is important. I mean, that just means so much. I think people don't understand that small acts of, you know, inclusion mean a lot. It brings me back to like when brands would repost pictures of Winter when she was a baby, and to them probably it was a very small act. Probably it was like, oh, I'm just reposting a picture of a cute baby in our whatever onesie brand. But to me it was like, no, like that is huge. Like, you're showing that my child who has a disability is just as valued as a child that does not have a disability. And you are saying it by doing that, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think a lot of people realize that they can do those little things, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. that idea that, I think I write about this in Scoot Over, Make Some Room, but like that there's always someone behind us, and we have to take time to look back. Not like back is bad, but just that it's like, okay, I have it for people who have a lot. I've had this huge table I can choose to invite people to. And then just sticking with that metaphor. And then once you get to the table and you've always felt like you were in the back, well, someone's behind you too, you know, mm-hmm. like there's someone behind you too. And so who can you turn around for? Cause we all have that, but I think we live in a society where we're constantly looking who's ahead of us. You know, like competitive, and it's just such the nature, especially I think of the West. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we all have that opportunity to make space in our lives.
Yeah.
For and others.
Also like valuing yourself, you know, self-love.
Mm, totally.
All of that too, you know.
You brought some good truth today, girl.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Can I jump in and take us back a tiny bit? Because you have brought up the mural, mm-hmm. and I'm really curious because I want to hear about the process of getting the mural. You worked on it at a local elementary school, right? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you were able to get this mural approved. And just tell us a little bit about how you got involved in doing that in your community.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it started with an article that I read, and that statistic sticking with me. And I was, you know, looking at all of the beautiful murals that were going up in honor, you know, of George Floyd and in downtown Oakland, and they were all on plywood. So, you know, ideally temporary, right? Like they were going to come down at some point. Though here in Oakland, they were trying to work out a way to preserve those pieces and maybe get them into like the Oakland Museum or something like that. I don't know if anything ever was worked out, but you know, I really wanted something permanent. I really wanted a mural that wasn't going to be taken down one day. And I came across a post from, at the time, not necessarily a friend, but an acquaintance of a local artist. She had just done a mural in honor of George Floyd. And I had just commented on it. Like, I was like, oh, it's so beautiful, you know, like, and there was like a article written up about it. And she had offered to create a mural for Black disabled lives, because she knew that I was starting to spread awareness around that and sharing posts around that. And of course, like, I couldn't say no. I was like, yes, like, let's do this. Like, I felt like it was a great way to, in a powerful way, I think art is very powerful, to share the message and for it to start the conversations. And so then the next step was finding a place that would allow it to happen and to be the home for it. So, and I made the mistake of thinking of this project as more personal when I realized that it's not about me. It's about the message. It's about community. It's about spreading awareness. And so, you know, I was making calls, you know, I was, you know, trying to email people and small businesses, and even got connected with a local disability organization here that I admire greatly, that loved the idea. And they had even thought about like having one of their disabled artists like be a part of it. But because of the pandemic, because of, you know, concerns with that, they were like, I don't think that's going to work out, but let's stay in touch. Like, maybe we can collab on something else. Then I went on social media and was like, okay, I got to use all my resources. And that means this, I got to put it out there. I got to put the message out there. Someone has to know someone that would want this mural and, you know, understand the importance of it. And, you know, people had shared it. It like got over like 2,000 shares. I've never had a post get shared that often. And then I had a woman contact me who worked for the Oakland School District. And she was like, you know, our special education building is being moved to a new campus. Let me get you in contact with the woman there and see what, you know, she says. They were so on board. They're like, yes, yes, like, let's do this. And I was like, oh my God, this is like really happy. Oh, like, okay, thank you. You know, like, let's get this going. And my friend now, an artist, you know, came up with this design, and you know, we just started it, and we put it out there, and we've gotten a lot of great feedback, and we have been in touch with a nonprofit in San Francisco that wanted to duplicate that mural. So, or they gave us the option of doing a different design. So there may in the future be a second Black Disabled Lives mural, hopefully in San Francisco. But we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens.
Wow. I love that. I love when art and music, poetry, all those beautiful things, you know, that I feel like lower defense, you know, they're easy to see or hear or they're inviting, you know, so your defense is down. People see it and their defense is down. And I feel like the message is shared in a different way for more people to hear it and see it.
Right.
So it's amazing. It's exciting.
Thank you.
And I think our listeners will be able to, they can go see, are your stories up about the mural if they wanted to go check it out?
Yes. Okay. I have a highlight. Black awesome. Disabled Lives mural.
Cool. Perfect. And will you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
On Instagram at Life with Winter and Nova, and Winter is spelled with a Y, not an I. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Beautiful.
All right. I'm really, really thankful for this conversation, and I hope that it sparks conversations for people listening. And before we wrap it up for good, we're going to hear from our sponsor, and then it's going to be time for some good news. So Elena, I hope that you will stick around and think about some good news to share about your daughter, Winter. Absolutely. We will be right back. When we found out our oldest daughter, Macy, was going to need glasses, I headed to the internet in search of adorable, fashionable, affordable frames and lenses. And I found the one and only Jonas Paul Eyewear. They offer exactly that. Fashionable frames they send straight to your home in their home try-on kits. You get 7 frames for 7 days at just $1. This means no extra trips to the eye doctor, no more feeling rushed or pressured to purchase before you're ready. You can test out glasses and order online, all from the safe, clean comfort of your couch. Macy absolutely loved this part in choosing her glasses. And once you've decided on which frames you like best, prescription glasses start at only $79, including prescription lenses. They're also offering non-prescriptive blue light glasses for only $59. And right now, for Lucky Few podcast listeners only, you can head to jonaspauleyewear.com/theluckyfew to save 15% on your next order.
All right, welcome back. It is time for our favorite part of the episode, and our very own Truly Star is going to bring us in.
Ready? Mm-hmm. Okay. Time for good news, time for good news. Everybody, welcome to the good news. Yeah, yeah.
Good news. Thank you, Truly. And Elena, we would love to know if you have any good news for us.
Well, when it comes to Winter, I would say the good news about her is just seeing her language develop. You know, she's been pretty much nonverbal for as long as I have known her, as long as she's been on this earth. I mean, she is a very chatty little girl. You know, when she was a baby, we always thought that was one of the things that wouldn't be such a challenge, that she would probably be verbal pretty quickly. You know, she loved talking to herself in the mirror. I mean, it's all, you know, babble. And but yeah, that became a huge challenge. But now she's stringing together, you know, three word sentences and being able to repeat words when we ask her to repeat them, and communicating with her words, you know, that it's not just so random anymore, that she's able to communicate with her peers when they ask her questions. And it's just been really incredible to witness. So I'm just grateful that that it's happening.
That's good news.
Beautiful. Yeah, so good. What about you, ladies? Heather, Mercedes, you got something good?
I have a good news, friends, because good news is the big and the little things. So Macy Moo, sweet, beautiful daughter entering adolescence, God bless the world. She has always had a difficult time with transitions. Like, hey, it's time to go from a place she doesn't want to leave. I get nervous asking her every time. We're somewhere I know she wants to be. And it's like, all right, time to go. Please come, please come, please come.
Yeah.
Please don't fall on the ground. We have we had this little like outdoor marketplace event, and there were these girlies there who are her age, and she like loves to see girlies her age. And they had a booth, they were selling products, and she so bad wanted to stay, and it just wasn't an option. And I said, Mason, we need to go now, knowing like this is not gonna happen. Like, we're staying here selling. Mason's gonna have to sell something because we're never leaving. And she said, Mom, I need one more minute. I'm not ready. I need a minute. And then I put a minute on the timer, and the timer went off, and she came. And that was really great. She left the girlies behind and listened, came with me. And I exhaled.
That's huge.
Good news.
And in front of her peers too. Like, that's way to go, Mace. Where that didn't have to be an issue. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool.
How about you, Merce?
Little Miss Sunflower, she has let down her guard so much and is welcoming other people into her circle. And what I mean by that, because she is generally pretty loving, but I felt like for a long stretch when she would meet peers, because language is such a barrier for her, she would go inward. And so like what was easy for her to say was like, no, or like have some sort of defense up. And lately I've seen her be like, hi, Sunny Rhodes. And like, so it's her scenario, you know, like she yes. Like she points, she always says, now she says hi. And then she likes to introduce her and her brothers. I feel like at one time Rhodes really used Sunflower as her, his crutch. And I feel like now it's kind of shifting and they're like really finding, I guess, strength in knowing that they have their siblings all the time. So now Sunny's like, Sunny Rhodes, you know, and she'll run up and say hi to people. And then like for a long time, I'd say like, oh, Sunny, we're going to go see your friend Cole. And then she'd be like, no, like, that's not my friend, you know, kind of thing. And now she's like, yes, Cole, my friend. I'm like, okay, good. You're warming up to friendships. Okay. And it's a kind of a big deal. And I'm really proud of her. And I hope it continues.
That's sweet.
I love
good
that.
Job. Good
go
news, Sunny.
Sunflower. Yeah, all around. We also have good news from a listener, Amy Squires, that Squires with a Y. And she says, today we are celebrating how well our almost three-year-old grandson, who has Down syndrome, is holding up his head during tummy time. He's getting so strong.
Good. Three-month-old.
You said 3 month old. Yeah, that's 3 month old. Big freaking deal holding up your head when you're 3 months old. And I love that we have a grandma writing in too with good news. Thanks for that, Amy. And thanks again, Elena, for being here with us. We just love having you and have loved getting to know you more, and especially seeing you over this past year and following your journey. Mm-hmm. It's been really beautiful to watch.
Oh, thank you, ladies. I appreciate it so much. I mean, I love watching you guys too. And thank you. I'm grateful. And thank you for having a seat for me at this table and giving me a meal and some dessert too.
Yes. Yeah. We might send you home with a bottle of wine.
We'll yes. Here. I like that.
Oh, yay. All right. And after our group hug, here we go. Group hug. Okay. Now, listeners, thank you so much for joining us too. And we just want to remind you not to miss out on the rest of our episodes this February, focusing on uplifting Black voices in the Down syndrome community. They've all been beautiful, and we're really grateful that we've been able to do it. As always, friends, we want to hear from you, so leave us a voicemail or a DM on Instagram and share about your family and your good news about your loved one with Down syndrome. And if you have a product or business that wants to help us shout the word of people with Down syndrome, you know we'd love to partner with you. You can email hello@theluckyfewpodcast.com for sponsorship opportunities. And a huge thank you to our editor, Josh Avis, to our producer, Val Schlieder, to our sponsor, and to all of you who have shared the Lucky Few podcast with friends and who have listened faithfully and cheered us on. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember that you, dear listener, supporting your loved one with Down syndrome, you are a shouter of worth and a narrative shifter. So keep on keeping on. We are cheering for you. See you next time on the Lucky Few podcast.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.